Good day. Welcome to another episode of the Audible Local Ledger Reads to the Blind podcast. You can get more information at audiblelocalledger.org. Stay tuned for today's reading. For Police Budget, Falmouth to Decide on Fate of 33 Guns by Rachel Devaney. The Falmouth Police Department wants to trade in $4,100 worth of surplus shotguns to help pay for new shotguns. But the Falmouth Gun Safety Coalition wants the 33 surplus guns destroyed. A financial loss for the town with the destruction of the guns is nothing compared to costs associated with rising gun violence, said Coalition President Nan Logan. We're trying to wake people up to that cost, said Logan on Wednesday. We haven't had any of those horrible Newtown Sandy Hook events here, but there's no reason why we wouldn't. Logan spoke at a February 12th Falmouth Select Board meeting. The coalition wants a surplus guns to be destroyed so that parts can't be resold and reused. The 33 surplus 12-gauge shotguns are to be sold back to Urick Brothers, a police supply vendor in Greenfield, as part of a deal to purchase new shotguns. The shotguns have a $4,100 trade-in value, said town manager Mike Renshaw. Falmouth Police Lieutenant Michael Simoneau confirmed the trade-in value. Police are waiting on a decision from Renshaw on whether the surplus weapons will be traded in or destroyed, Simoneau said. Police Chief Jeffrey Lurie couldn't be immediately reached by the Times for comment. The issue reignites questions that were raised in 2022 when Falmouth Police traded in semi-automatic weapons to a Hyannis gun dealer as part of a purchase deal for more semi-automatic weapons. The financial loss of $4,100 for the town could be a legal issue as well, town officials said. So what's the town policy? While $4,100 isn't a significant amount, it's meaningful for the police budget, Renshaw said in a phone interview. Without accounting for that financial loss, he said, the select board's fiduciary duty could be breached. An existing town policy, said Renshaw, gives him the authority to make the final decision on whether the surplus weapons will be traded in or destroyed. Conversations between Renshaw and Lurie remain ongoing, Renshaw said. But some select board members wanted to explore options on how the public could donate towards the $4,100 trade-in value and the guns could be destroyed. I don't want to give an impression that we've made the final decision and that they're going to be destroyed, said Renshaw. The police chief and I have not made that decision. The town isn't generally allowed to destroy goods that were paid for with municipal funds, town council Maura O'Keefe said. But if taxpayers exhibit a desire to destroy a particular set of goods and forego that fiduciary duty, then the select board would be able to go ahead and do that without undermining fiduciary duty, she said. A bylaw codifying a policy to destroy surplus firearms was passed during the May 2022 town meeting, O'Keefe said. However, the Attorney General's office rejected the bylaw because of State Procurement Act conflicts that couldn't be resolved. A previous Powderhorn decision is an influence. In June of 2022, Falmouth residents expressed concerns about a deal between the police and Powderhorn Outfitters, a former hunting and shooting shop in Hyannis. At the time, police were set to buy 38 semi-automatic weapons from Powderhorn Outfitters and trade in 21 semi-automatic weapons. That deal would allow the police to receive credit toward the purchase. About 300 Falmouth residents signed a petition for the town to dismantle and destroy the police department's surplus weapons instead. The petitioners feared that the older rifles could eventually wind up in civilian hands, although that might be done legally is something that isn't really mentioned. The deal went forward as approved by then-acting town manager Peter Johnson Staub after Powderhorn Outfitters agreed to only sell the weapons to local law enforcement. But Select Board member Anjali Scott Price said at the time that the Select Board would carefully consider surplus weapon policies moving forward. A nonprofit revolving fund is suggested. Renshaw said a revolving fund managed by a nonprofit could help mitigate the trade-in value for surplus weapons. The public could donate to that revolving fund, he said, and replace the $4,100, along with future financial losses stemming from surplus weapons. There's no identified nonprofit to oversee a revolving fund so far, Renshaw told the Times. If a nonprofit was developed, O'Keefe said the Select Board would be prohibited from targeting solicitations from the public. Select Board Chair Nancy Taylor asked Renshaw to bring information and legal guidance back to the board by March 25th. Where the money comes from isn't particularly relevant, said O'Keefe. It just might be helpful if there was an organized 501c3 to help raise funds for this purpose. So how would the weapons be destroyed? Even if the surplus guns are destroyed, Renshaw said, there's concern about how they'll be disposed of and where they'll end up. Select Board member Robert Muscali said surplus weapons that are destroyed are sometimes dismantled and refit into new weapons. They are somehow repurposed, said Muscali. That's also been a concern for Logan. Often, she said, police departments say they're destroying guns, but the weapons are given to a company that takes them away for free, then disassembles the weapons and sells parts piece by piece. We want to see them destroyed officially, Logan said. A gun buyback program in 2018. In 2018, Logan and other advocates of gun safety organized a gun buyback event, where 100 guns were turned in to the Falmouth police in return for grocery gift cards. During that time, Logan said the group found a scrap metal dealer who destroyed the guns at no charge. We watched as every gun was trashed, she said. Logan hopes the surplus rifles can be destroyed in the same manner. Renshaw said he's also heard that dismantled guns can be turned into garden tools, maybe turning them into shovels. That's another concept that's been discussed, he said. Some think gun trade-in value should remain intact. Falmouth resident Mark Finneran, during the Select Board meeting, said guns in the community aren't the problem. It's the people using the guns that are the problem. The Reverend Deborah Warner, during the meeting, said she's ready to work with members of the Select Board and other town government leaders to fulfill citizens' fiduciary duties. We know what the aftermath looks like when an active shooter fires shots. We've seen footage over and over again far too often, said Warner, who's a rector at Church of the Messiah in Falmouth. We can pay the price and choose to stop the flow of guns. We can do that. In fact, we must. There's a large photo in the center of the Cape Cod Times front page today. A new calf at Taylor Bray Farm is the headline over it, and the caption reads, Spaghetti and her new bull calf, Bray, take in the afternoon sun on Sunday. Bray was born February 29th at Taylor Bray Farm. With the arrival of Bray, there are three generations of Scottish Highland cattle at the Yarmouthport Farm. Spaghetti, 7 years old, joined the farm January 4th. She is Chloe's daughter, who has been at Taylor Bray Farm since 2017. She and Spaghetti were donated by Pleasant Lake Farm in Harwich. And there is a beautiful picture of a bull calf, Bray, and a beautiful colored, sort of a sienna, burnt brown, orangish brown colored cattle. Beautiful, beautiful cattle. Moving inside the paper, keeping it local, we'll move to the Cape and Islands section. Hiring for Barnstable Police may be eased after civil service review by Heather McCarron. Whether or not to remove the Barnstable Police Department from the Massachusetts Civil Service is a question members of the department and others will explore in coming weeks, now that the town council has given the investigation the green light and financial support. On Thursday, council members approved $35,000 to fund consulting services and overtime costs associated with the study. The funding's a one-time request and will come from the town's general fund reserve, which presently has a balance of $29,148,778. Civil service requires towns that have departments under its auspices to follow a hiring and promotions process, which critics say is outdated and cumbersome. Barnstable voters chose to place certain town positions under civil service in 1937 when the program was still a newfangled idea, Human Resources Director William Cole said. But over time, it's evolved, and we are now looking and exploring options of whether or not we should remove our police department from civil service, he said. The police department is the only department in town that remains under civil service. Back in 1937, I think there were some others, but over time, with the change in the form of town government and a bunch of things, they dropped out, he said. Council Vice President Craig Tamash agrees it's high time for the discussion. As someone who worked with civil service and had to negotiate the bureaucracy and some of the arcane rules that they have, I've advocated this for years, he said. It's long overdue. What is civil service in Massachusetts? Among other functions, civil service provides hiring and promotional exams, both for internal and external searches, and ranks candidates for consideration. And town hiring officers or panels must follow certain protocols throughout. According to the Massachusetts Municipal Association, towns opting out of the service have cited overly restrictive policies, making it difficult to attract candidates. The Massachusetts legislature enacted the civil service system in 1884 as a means of combating corruption, cronyism, and political interference in hiring and discipline within certain services, such as police and fire, all issues that are now avoided through collective bargaining, according to material on the association's website. So what's next? Cole said during recent discussions with the town's two police unions, there was a commitment by all parties to explore this. The funding will pay for consulting services as well as overtime, he said. That's going to be incurred by members of the department that will be on working groups looking at this removal from civil service. Thursday's discussion before the council was not to determine whether or not the town should opt out of civil service for police, but rather was limited to discussing the purpose of the funding request. Cole said the consultants and police staff will consider all the different facets that we have to consider if we're going to come out of civil service. It's presently hoped a recommendation may be brought back to the council for discussion and a vote sometime this summer, he said. But it just depends on the progress of the working groups as they go through this, because there's a lot of things that need to be unpacked. Will civil service study affect hiring a new Barnstable police chief? Councillor Paula Schnepp wondered if the question about whether to leave civil service could affect the process of hiring a new police chief. The town's in the market for a new chief after the recent quiet retirement on January 29th of former chief Matthew Sonnebend, a 26-year veteran of the department. Town manager Mark Ells appointed deputy chief Gene Challies, who's marking 22 years with the department this year, as the provisional chief. Cole said at this time about the potential exit from civil service and hiring of a new chief that they are being looked at as two separate items, but he didn't discount the possibility that they could end up merging into one should the town opt out before the town is ready to select a new chief. And we'll keep it local with some sports. It is playoff and tournament time. Normally we don't do much sports, but when it's playoffs and tournaments, even high school sports become very relevant to towns and communities. So we want to make sure you're up to date. Next stop, TD Garden. Nauset Boys Hockey advances to state title game by Andre Sims. In Bourne, they say the road to TD Garden goes through Gallo Ice Arena. And there, during Sunday night's Massachusetts Interscholastic Athletic Association Division III Final Four game, known as the MIAA, the number one Nauset boys hockey team showed it also goes through them. The top-seeded Warriors, who were 22-1 on the season, advanced to the state title game after a comprehensive 6-0 win over number 12 Somerset Berkeley. It was a game in which the Warriors sent a message that they've ultimately been delivering all year. We know that we're the best team here. We're the best for a reason, and if we play how we should play, we're going to win, junior captain Logan Poland said. Across four playoff games, the Warriors have outscored their opponents 18-2, including 10-1 in the last two rounds. At the heart of it is a relentless drive to smother the opposition. The Warriors got to this point by dominating the teams they face, and the semifinal win was no different. The Warriors raced out to an early commanding lead like they did in the Elite Eight. Three goals in just over 4 minutes from Aaron Howard, Logan Poulin, and Jake Eldridge quickly put the Warriors out of reach, with each goal the result of sustained pressure in the Somerset Berkeley zone. The benefit of the Warriors' constant pressure went well beyond the scoreboard. As the pressure continued to mount, the Raiders' internal clock began to speed up, and that result was hurried passes, turnovers, and unforced errors, all of which played into Nauset's hands. I think it's just our team identity. Really, just bringing the pressure every single shift. The relentlessness every single shift, Nauset head coach Connor Brickley said. You can't let your foot off the gas pedal. You can't let other teams breathe. That's how you wear teams down. You suffocate them, and you make them panic just a little bit more. Dominating the puck only becomes worth it if it leads to goals, and the Warriors have no issue there. Their depth was once again on display, with five different skaters lighting the lamp and nine total point scorers. Leading the way as he has all season was Poulin, P-O-U-L-I-N is his spelling. He finished with two goals and an assist, and all season long has been a constant threat. He's not afraid of the moment, Brickley said of his captain. No stage is too big, and he's only getting better with each and every game. The stage is set for him, and I can't wait to see what he comes out with next Sunday. Ask his teammates, and a couple key attributes of Poulin's game stick out. First, his athleticism. For all his skills on the ice, he's actually committed to play NCAA Division I lacrosse at UNH, the University of New Hampshire, and the two sports benefit each other. The second thing is his intelligence, which senior assistant captain Julian Crivo said is a rare combination. His speed and his hockey IQ, between those two, he can find anybody on the ice, and he can skate by anybody he wants, and he can find his teammates better than anyone I've ever seen. Three goals quickly became five in the second period as Poulin's second and a goal from Colin Ward put the game farther out of reach. After the game, Krivos, whose third-period goal wrapped up the scoring, said the key to Nauset's smothering approach lies in their coaches. It really comes down to our coaching, Krivos said. We've got an amazing group of coaches behind us on the bench. They give us the keys to success. They give us the drawing, and we go from there. The win has the Warriors on the verge of reaching their ultimate goal. Standing in their way is number 6 Marblehead on March 17th at TD Garden. But Poulin said the team's mentality and approach doesn't change regardless of the opposition. Rankings don't matter and numbers don't matter, Poulin said. We have a screw you mentality to the other team. We want to win this. Such is the mentality of the entire team as they close in on the title. Crucially, they feel like they're peaking at the right time. And just put together their strongest game of the year. Yes, Poulin said when asked if the Final Four win was the Warriors' best game of the season. But I also feel like that's not the best we could put together. I think we have a lot more in the tank, and that's a scary thing. And in girls' hockey, Marshfield High, my hometown, ousted by Falmouth in the state semifinals. And this is reported by David Walcott, Jr. The journey to a state title is always a rough road, but it beats the sudden stop at the journey. The incredible run of the Marshfield High girls hockey team from 3 games under 500 to 1 game short of playing at the TD Garden for a championship ended Sunday night at the John Gallo Ice Arena with a 2-0 loss to Falmouth High in the Division II state semifinals. The power ranking for the bracket turned out to be right on the mark, at least at the top of the list. It'll be number 1 Duxbury, who's 23-3, against number 2 Falmouth, 23-1, facing off Sunday at the Garden for the Division II state championship. The time is to be determined. We had a good start, and then I think we got a little nervous in the second period and stopped skating, said Falmouth head coach Brian Ferreira. I don't know if it was nerves or what, but at the end of the day, who cares? We've got another week together, and we're going to the Garden. It was a little bit of ugly hockey there for a while. We're so young, it's hard to say what was going on, but I'm not going to be complaining. Ferreira praised the work of both goaltenders, his own Aspen Devlin and Marshfield's Morgan Murphy, for limiting everything to the one even-strength goal in the opening period by junior Casey Roth, and then an empty netter in the closing minute by senior Avery Johnson. Devlin's a freshman and Murphy's a sophomore, so they have a couple more chances to do this in the playoffs again. The goaltending was great at both ends of the ice, Ferreira said. Falmouth scored more than 100 goals this season, and the Clippers were on the attack right away. The Clippers got what they were looking for with 1:02 left in the opening period when Roth came rushing down the slot from the blue line to put the puck in the net. Marshfield had several chances in the second and third periods to tie the game. There were some rough patches in the middle period when the teams combined for 5 minor penalties. But the Rams came back in the third period with some intense pressure as they searched for a tying goal that would never arrive. Johnson filled an empty net with 34.5 seconds left to make the final score 2-0. Those kids have battled all year. This is a tough way to go out when we were one win away from playing at the Garden, said Marshfield head coach Tom Greeland. Falmouth is a very good hockey team, and we played right there with them. They took it to us in the first period, but I think we battled back, and we had some great opportunities to tie the game in the second and third periods. Sometimes you just need a little of that puck luck with you. It wasn't with us tonight. Marshfield closes out the season with a record of 15-9, but more importantly, winners of 11 of their final 13 games this year to get to the state semifinals. They were under 500. The 11th seed skated to wins over Norwell, Scituate, Abington, Leominster, and then they upset number 3 Burlington to get on the ice against a speedy and very talented Falmouth hockey team. 3 is a big number for the Rams moving forward. That's the number of seniors on the Rams roster this season. Senior co-captain Ariana Altobello and Addison Brown, as well as their classmate Sinead Doyle. The 10 juniors and 13 underclassmen coming back with this experience, the best may be yet to come. We all feel that we can get back together and have another strong year, said Greeland. We showed this year that we can play as a team and as a family. That completes the sports page, which means we've completed all of the local news that is in the Cape Cod Times for today, March 12th of 2024. Moving over to the cover again, to the front page, we'll move to the national and regional news. Biden budget would hike spending 4.6%. Says plans would reduce deficit by $3 trillion. This is reported by Michael Collins and Joey Garrison in Washington. President Joe Biden released a federal budget Monday that seeks to protect entitlements and reduce the deficit by $3 trillion over the next decade by raising taxes on corporations and the wealthiest Americans. Biden's $7.3 trillion budget for the 2025 fiscal year, that's a 4.6% increase over the current budget, seeks to boost defense spending by 1.8% and non-defense discretionary spending by 2.7%. The spending falls below caps that House Republicans pushed in last year's Fiscal Responsibility Act that raised the debt limit. Although the budget has no chance of advancing in the GOP-controlled House of Representatives, it establishes Biden's priorities for his campaign against likely Republican nominee Donald Trump, particularly his efforts to appeal to working-class voters. We're the only nation that's emerged from every crisis we've entered stronger than we went in. While my administration has seen great progress since day one, there's still work to do. My budget will help make that promise real, Biden wrote in a budget document to Congress. Biden's budget proposes tax hikes on billionaires and corporations to cut the deficit by $3 trillion over the next 10 years while not reducing spending on entitlements. The president would reverse the corporate tax rate cut that Trump and congressional Republicans passed in 2017 by raising that rate from 21% to 28%. Biden is also pushing to increase a new minimum on the largest billion-dollar corporations, which he signed into law in 2022, from 15% to 21%. The president's budget includes a new 25% minimum tax on the wealthiest 0.01% of Americans, those with wealth over $100 million. And he's calling for new plans to deny tax deductions for corporations that pay any employee more than $1 million and to close a loophole that gives tax breaks to owners of corporate jets. Biden, who regularly accuses Republicans of wanting to slash Medicare and Social Security, bolsters spending for both programs in his budget. He proposes to extend the solvency of Medicare by increasing the Medicare tax rate on Americans who earn more than $400,000 a year, closing various loopholes in existing Medicare taxes, and directing revenue from the net investment income tax. The White House hasn't proposed a similar plan to extend the solvency of Social Security, but it has outlined steady spending increases over the next 10 years. The 2025 budget would spend 6.2% more on Social Security than the current year. Social Security and Medicare are more than government programs, said Shalonda Young, who's director at the Office of Management and Budget. They're a promise, a rock-solid guarantee generations of Americans have counted on. Biden and Democrats have long attacked Republicans by warning they can't be trusted to protect Medicare and Social Security. On Monday, the White House seized on remarks Trump made in an interview with CNBC in which the former president said, "There's a lot you can do in terms of entitlements, just in terms of cutting them." Billions for border security. Biden sought $13.6 billion in emergency funding from Congress last fall to manage the surge of arrivals at the U.S.-Mexico border. But after Trump opposed a bipartisan border security bill, House Republicans tanked it. Up to now, politics have intervened, Biden said Monday in remarks to the National League of Cities. We have to end the games. Biden's proposal, again, calls for measures to improve security and deal with immigration at the southern border. The plan includes $405 million to hire 1,300 Border Patrol agents, $755 million to hire 1,600 asylum officers and support staff to handle immigration cases more quickly, and $239 million for 1,000 Customs and Border Patrol officers to stop fentanyl and other contraband from entering the country. It would allocate $849 million for cutting-edge technology to detect illicit drugs and other contraband at ports of entry. In addition, Biden is asking for $1.3 billion to hire 375 immigration judge teams to reduce the backlog of immigration cases. The president also proposed a $4.7 billion contingency fund that the Department of Homeland Security could tap to boost security operations if there's a migrant surge at the southwest border, and that fund would receive annual appropriations. Biden offered several proposals to lower costs for families who are struggling financially. The president's budget would restore the full child tax credit enacted in the American Rescue Plan. Under that law, the maximum tax credit increased from $2,000 to $3,600 per child under age of 6 and to $3,000 per child aged 6 to 17. Congress allowed the credit to expire at the end of 2021. Biden also is proposing a new program under which working families with incomes up to $200,000 per year would be guaranteed affordable, high-quality child care from birth until kindergarten. Under the proposal, most families would pay no more than $10 a day. The lowest income families would pay nothing. The administration says the proposal would benefit the parents of more than 16 million children. To help expand home ownership, Biden is proposing a new mortgage relief credit to help increase access to affordable housing. The proposal includes a new tax credit for middle-class, first-time homebuyers of up to $10,000 over 2 years. Biden is also calling on Congress to provide a one-year tax credit of up to $10,000 to middle-class families who sell their starter home. Biden's spending plan now goes to Congress, which is in charge of writing the federal budget. The president's proposal will become the starting point for negotiations between lawmakers and the White House. However, the House is unlikely to go along with many of the president's proposals, especially those to let tax breaks for wealthy people expire. So, the final budget is expected to look far different from the document Biden proposed on Monday. Next headline, election 2024, Trump and Biden close to clinching races. This is really a foregone conclusion at this stage, barring some very outrageous behavior or somebody passing or something. This is going to be our choice. Tuesday votes could give enough to both delegates. By Steve Peoples of the Associated Press in New York. President Joe Biden and likely Republican challenger Donald Trump are on track to win enough delegates this week to become their party's presumptive nominees, ushering in a bruising 8-month campaign for the White House. Elections in 4 states Tuesday will likely give Biden and Trump the delegates they need to clinch the nominations. Their trajectories are hardly in doubt after dominant performances in last week's Super Tuesday contests forced the last major primary challengers out of the race. But for many voters who aren't attuned to the daily twists and turns of the nation's turbulent politics, this week could be a crystallizing moment, reinforcing that another Biden-Trump campaign is virtually guaranteed whether Americans want it or not. And that rematch, the first in a U.S. presidential election since 1956, is poised to deepen searing political and cultural divides. Here's what we're watching. Will Trump clinch the nomination? Tuesday, today, will be a wake-up call for those who still doubt that Trump, who's facing 91 felony counts and 4 criminal cases, will represent the Republican Party in the general election this fall. The former president's on track to win enough delegates to become the Republican Party's presumptive presidential nominee if he continues to dominate the way he has throughout the primary season. And with no major opposition on the ballot, there is every reason to believe he will. As of Sunday, Trump was 140 delegates short of the 1,215 needed to win the Republican nomination at the party's national convention this summer. There are 161 Republican delegates at stake on Tuesday in Georgia, Mississippi, Washington State, and Hawaii. With a strong showing on Tuesday, Trump can sweep all the delegates in Georgia, Mississippi, and Washington State. Hawaii allocates delegates proportionately so other candidates could win a few even with a small share of the vote. But what about Biden? Democrats who did not want Biden to run again are about to be disappointed. Like Trump, Biden's on the verge of securing sufficient delegates to become the Democratic Party's presumptive presidential nominee. President enters Tuesday's 102 delegates short of the 1,968 needed to win the Democratic nomination, and there are 254 Democratic delegates at stake Tuesday in Georgia, Mississippi, and Washington State, in addition to party-run contests for the Northern Mariana Islands and Democrats abroad that conclude that day. With no major opponents, Biden's on pace to reach that mark, but he's also facing continued resistance from his party's left flank, the ultra-liberals, that threatens to tarnish the achievement. A collection of progressive activists and faith leaders in Georgia and other states is encouraging Democratic primary participants not to vote for any presidential candidate. That's after a protest uncommitted vote in Michigan recently secured 2 delegates. The symbolic protest is meant as a warning on Biden's re-election over his support for Israel's war against Hamas in Gaza. While Biden's campaign says it's not worried, the president must unite his party behind him if he hopes to defeat Trump in November. Following a fiery State of the Union that he says fueled $10 million in donations in just 24 hours, Biden has an opportunity to build new momentum with a strong showing on Tuesday. Georgia has emerged as one of the nation's premier swing states in recent years, and both candidates are eager to put up a strong showing and flex their organizational muscle in what is effectively a dress rehearsal for November's far more consequential general election. The state was a pivotal battleground in 2020, so close that Trump finds himself indicted there over his push to find 11,780 votes and overturn Biden's victory. Both candidates made Georgia a priority in the days leading up to Tuesday's primary, but they offered very different messages in dueling rallies over the weekend. Trump's Saturday rally opened with a message asking attendees to support the people serving time in jail for their roles in the January 6th Capitol insurrection, where over 100 police officers were injured. The former president then appeared with a MAGA firebrand, Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, a Republican from Georgia, known as MTG to her disciples, whom he called brave for yelling at Biden during his State of the Union address. He called her brave, not rude. Trump also highlighted his private meeting the night before with Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orbán, who has rolled back democracy in his country and is basically a dictator. Biden working to energize his coalition of voters of color, young people, and suburbanites pointed to Trump's controversial associates and his embrace of the far right. "Our freedoms are literally on the ballot this November," he said. Is this race about to change? With both candidates poised to clinch their nominations, we're about to move formally from the primary to the general election phase of the 2024 election. But it's fair to say we don't know exactly what that will look like. Typically at this moment, candidates will shift their message to speak to a broader swath of voters, especially moderates and independents who play a more influential role in general elections compared to the hardcore base voters who decide primaries. But if this weekend was any indication, Trump is showing little interest or ability to embrace a more moderate tone. He's still falsely insisting that the 2020 election was stolen and praising those who stormed the Capitol and injured police. We'll be paying close attention to the tone of his response and his social media posts after he clinches that nomination. On the Democratic side, we're about to learn whether Biden's coalition changes its view on the reality as the reality sets in, that this election is now a binary choice between Biden and Trump. And Biden's campaign is betting big that that's the case and people will come up for Biden. We're several minutes past the midway point in our reading, and regular listeners are well aware, I'm sure, that it's at this stage in our reading that we move to a different kind of local news, which is the obituaries and death notices that are published in that day's paper. Today in the Cape Cod Times, dated March 12th of 2024, the first obituaries of John Francis Walsh of Mashpee, known as Jack, who passed away peacefully surrounded by his loving family on March 8th. He was beloved husband of Janet Walsh, with whom he shared 60 years of marriage. Jack was born February 26, 1939, in Somerville, proud son of first-generation Irish immigrants. He was raised in Brighton and after high school went on to graduate from Boston University with a bachelor's degree. Jack enjoyed a lengthy career as a successful senior executive for 30 years at Sears Roebuck, based in Chicago. He was a resident of Mashpee for 24 years and was very active in the community. He was a devoted parishioner at Christ the King Parish in Mashpee. He was an active member of the Seabrook Shores Association and a faithful volunteer at the polls each election day. Jack was a natural athlete and played many sports, including tennis, golf, running, hockey, and biking. He also had a love for gardening and home improvement projects. But more than anything, Jack is remembered for being a devoted and loving husband, father, grandfather, and friend. He's survived by his wife, Janet Walsh, and many who will miss him dearly. A visitation will be held on Thursday, March 14th, that's this Thursday, from 4 p.m. to 7 p.m. at Chapman Funerals and Cremations at 74 Algonquin Avenue. That's Route 151 in Mashpee. A funeral mass will be held this Friday, March 15th, at 11 a.m. at Christ the King Parish, 5 Job's Fishing Road in Mashpee, with burial to immediately follow at Great Neck Woods Cemetery, Great Neck Road South in Mashpee. The next obituary is of Michael J. Frucci of South Yarmouth, who at the age of 85 passed away peacefully on March 6th. Michael was born in Norwood and attended Westwood Schools, advancing his education at Stonehill College and UConn, where he studied economics. His education and business savvy eventually brought him to the Cape Cod Chamber of Commerce. As executive secretary for 27 years, he played a significant role in the growth of the Cape's tourism industry. His love of Cape Cod was evident by his knowledge of its history and people, as well as his love for sailing and fishing. He was active in the Mackenzie Boat Club, and his beloved Foggy Notion could be seen regularly in Barnstable Harbor and around the Cape's waters. Michael was very proud of his Italian heritage, which showed through his love of gardening, cooking, entertaining family and friends, making homemade wine in the North End, and of course his great devotion to St. Anthony. Michael leaves behind his son, Michael Jr., and dear friends. A funeral mass will be celebrated at 11 a.m. on Saturday, March 16th, that's this Saturday, at St. Pius X Catholic Church at Station Ave in South Yarmouth. The final obituary in today's Cape Cod Times, that's dated March 12th of 2024, is of James Luther Connor of East Sandwich, who at the age of 88 passed away peacefully on February 20th after a lengthy illness with his wife Sylvia by his side. Originally from Troy, New York, Jim was one of eight children, and after graduating from high school, Jim enlisted in the Army and served his country in both the Texas Army National Guard and on active duty in the Signal Corps from 1954 through 1958. While on active duty, Jim was stationed in New York and completed an overseas service tour in Taiwan as a sergeant. Mr. Connor, thank you for your service and sacrifice for the country. Jim studied at SUNY New Paltz, earning a bachelor's degree in 1962 and then taught in New York public schools. Jim met Sylvia when they were teaching at Waterford Public Schools. After they married, he studied art history at Penn State, sculpture at the University of Utah, and was granted a sabbatical from Britton Kill New York Public Schools to research the Roman influence on church architecture in southern France. He was grateful to the French government and the cities of Orange, France, for aiding him in his research, and in 1967 he received a master's from SUNY New Paltz. In 1980, he, Sylvia, and son Alex moved to Sandwich, where he started Interactive Training Courseware, which was a computer programming business. He continued to work at his art, doing painting and sculpture, inspired by his research in France, as well as a practical restoration of his home. Jim is survived by his wife of 61 years, Sylvia Connor, and many who will miss him dearly, as well as his son Alex, who remembered his year in France as one of the happiest in his life. The family would like to thank the Sandwich EMTs for their many acts of kindness and the wonderful caregivers from TLC Private Home Care Services and the McCarthy Hospice Care Center. A celebration of life service will be held on April 13th at 11 a.m. at St. John's Episcopal Church, 159 Main Street in Sandwich. In lieu of flowers, any donations in his memory may be made to the Sandwich Fire Department at P.O. Box 1340, Sandwich, Mass. 02563. And that concludes the obituaries and death notices that are listed in the Cape Cod Times dated Tuesday, March 12th of 2024. Some interesting news from Brookline. In 2020, Brookline okayed a unique tobacco sales ban. And what the Supreme Justice Court says, or the state Supreme Justice Court. This is written by Dan O'Brien in Brookline. The state Supreme Judicial Court, I guess I got those letters wrong, Supreme Judicial Court announced last Friday it's upheld Brookline's so-called tobacco-free generation bylaw, which bans the sale of tobacco products to anyone born after January 1st of 2000. The ruling comes a year and a half after a lower court dismissed a lawsuit brought against the town by local store owners who claimed the ban is unconstitutional and that it conflicted with state law that set Massachusetts' minimum age to buy tobacco at 21. Brookline passed its bylaw, Article 14, at town meeting in November of 2020, and it became effective in August of 2021. In a statement, town officials called the SJC ruling a win for health and wellness advocates and for the vitality and importance of municipal government. By affirming a lower court's dismissal of the tobacco industry's challenge of the bylaw, the state's highest court validated the town's legitimate interest in mitigating tobacco use overall, and in particular the case of minors, said Town Council Joe Callanan in a statement. Municipalities have a leading role to play in protecting the public health, and especially here, protecting young people from the dangers of tobacco products. The SJC found that the town's incremental approach to prohibiting tobacco sales was expressly permitted by the state law raising the age to purchase tobacco to 21, noting that communities have considerable latitude in enacting local bylaws. The owners of three Brookline gas stations and convenience stores filed their suit a month after the bylaw became effective in August of 2021. A trial court dismissed the initial challenge in October of 22. In approving Brooklines in 2021, the Massachusetts Attorney General's office, which was then headed by now Governor Maura Healey, argued the ban didn't conflict with state law as the two policies have similar goals. The SJC has today handed a victory to public health leaders who have been searching for a way out, a way for our next generation to avoid falling victim to the many pitfalls of tobacco use, said Sigale Rice, Brooklines Director of Public Health and Human Services, in a statement. The next headline, Trump asks to postpone New York trial on hush money, by Bart Jansen. Former President Donald Trump has asked to postpone his New York hush money criminal trial by pointing to his presidential immunity claim under consideration at the Supreme Court. Trump argues he's shielded because he was president at the time some of his actions took place. But legal experts said it would be difficult to argue that paying hush money to women was part of Trump's official duties as president to qualify for immunity. At the federal level, Trump has argued Supreme Court precedents protect him from criminal charges. Without immunity from criminal prosecution based on official acts, the president's political opponents will seek to influence and control his or her decisions via de facto extortion or blackmail with the threat, explicit or implicit, of indictment by a future hostile administration for facts that do not warrant any such prosecution, his lawyers wrote. Federal prosecutors and judges in District Court and D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals have ruled that Trump can be charged. For the purpose of this criminal case, former President Trump has become Citizen Trump, with all the defenses of any other criminal defendant, the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals ruled regarding Trump's federal election case. Any executive immunity that may have protected him while he served as president no longer protects him against this prosecution. The Supreme Court will hear arguments on the question April 25th, but the New York trial is scheduled to begin March 25th. Trump has pleaded not guilty to 34 counts of falsifying business records in New York. Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg argued that the former president falsified the records to hide hush money payments before the 2016 election to Stormy Daniels, a pornographic actress, and Karen McDougal, a former Playboy model, to stop them from talking about allegations that he had sex with them. Trump contends because the issue is unique, no former president has ever faced criminal charges before, that New York Judge Juan Merchan should postpone his case at least until the Supreme Court rules to avoid potentially having to hold the trial twice. The adjournment would also avoid the unnecessary risk of inconsistent adjudications as to the defenses asserted by President Trump in state and federal courts relating to the presidential immunity doctrine, Trump lawyers Todd Blanche and Susan Nicellis wrote in their filing. The adjournment would mitigate the risk that an error in the application of this complex federal law issue could require the court, the parties, the state, the city, and the county to expend the resources necessary to retry the case. Our next headline, Ramadan begins, Israel warns Hamas, efforts to send more aid to Palestinians progresses, by John Bacon. The holy month of Ramadan prompted fasting and worship by Muslims around the world Monday, but it brought no end to the death and destruction wrought by the war in the Gaza Strip, despite intense effort by the U.S. and other nations to broker a ceasefire. Palestinians prayed amid rubble and fear after talks stalled over Israel's resolve to crush Hamas and the militant group's demands for a pathway to permanent peace and the withdrawal of all Israeli troops from Gaza, which will never happen. Israel has vowed to expand its offensive to the southern Gaza city of Rafah, where more than 1 million Palestinians have sought refuge since the war began October 7th with a deadly Hamas-led rampage into Israel. Hamas has called for stepped-up resistance, drawing a warning from Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant. I say to everyone who is thinking of trying us this month, we're ready. Don't make mistakes, he said. President Joe Biden issued a statement acknowledging that the sacred month has arrived at a moment of immense pain in the enclave as the death toll surpasses 31,000, according to the Palestinian Authority, while almost 2 million remain displaced. He said the U.S. will continue leading the effort to increase humanitarian aid to the Palestinian people while working nonstop to broker a peace agreement. As Muslims gather around the world over the coming days and weeks to break their fast, the suffering of the Palestinian people will be front of mind for many, Biden said. It's front of mind for me. Majoub Zewairi, a professor at Qatar University, told Al Jazeera the U.S. pressured Israel not to tighten access restrictions at East Jerusalem's Al-Aqsa Mosque, Islam's third holiest in the West Bank. If the Israelis do not listen to the Americans, West Bank is likely to become another Gaza in a matter of months, Zewairi warned. Israel announced last week it would not reduce the number of worshippers allowed to pray at the site for at least a week while monitoring security. The mosque is part of Temple Mount, the holiest place in Judaism, where two biblical temples once stood. Jordan Foreign Minister Ayman Safadi warned Monday that any restrictions imposed by Israel on Muslim worshippers' access to the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound during Ramadan could result in an explosion. Video posted on social media Sunday night appeared to show Israeli border police clashing with worshippers and police saying they were working to enable freedom of worship while ensuring safety and security. Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Monday defended his plan to expand Israel's military offensive into Rafah over the objection of Biden and other world leaders, saying he doesn't want to leave a quarter of the Hamas terror army in place. Netanyahu, speaking on Fox News Channel's Fox and Friends, said Biden agrees Hamas must be destroyed, and unless Hamas is defeated completely, the militant group will just regroup, regain control of Gaza, and repeat, as they've said they would do often, the October 7th rampage that killed almost 1,200 people and saw about 250 hostages seized, Netanyahu said. Biden wants to ensure the safe departure of more than a million Palestinians who have sought refuge in Rafah before we go in. We agree with that, Netanyahu said. Look, it's either Israel or Hamas. There's no middle way, Netanyahu said. We can't leave a quarter of the Hamas terror army in place, and they're there. They're right there in Rafah. This would be equivalent to saying, you know, after the Allies fought back and went through Normandy and went through Germany, and you'd say, well, we'll leave a quarter of the Nazi army in place. We won't go into Berlin. It's the last stronghold. The U.S. and other countries have begun airdropping aid in recent days, but humanitarian groups say such efforts are costly and insufficient. The U.S. military has also begun transporting equipment to build a sea bridge to deliver aid, but it will likely be several weeks before it's operational. A ship belonging to Spanish aid group Open Arms, carrying 200 tons of food aid, was expected to make a pilot voyage to Gaza from nearby Cyprus, though it wasn't clear when it would depart. Israel says it welcomes the sea deliveries and will inspect Gaza-bound cargo before it leaves Cyprus. An explosion took place near a ship in the Red Sea on Monday, but the ship's master said no one was hurt, the British military's United Kingdom Maritime Trade Operations Center said. The attack likely came from the Yemen-based Houthi rebels who have been targeting ships, claiming support for Palestinians in Gaza. The private security firm Ambre say the incident may have involved a missile, but few details were available, and the Houthis issued no immediate statement. Progressive groups form coalition to counter pro-Israel groups. Facing a barrage of super PAC money, more than 20 progressive groups are coming together to forcefully counter offensives by pro-Israel political action committees like the American Israel Public Affairs Committee to mount primary election challenges to liberal members of Congress who've been critics of Israel's blistering military offensive in Gaza. The coalition called Reject AIPAC includes Jewish peace organizations and Arab American and Muslim groups that have been organizing in record numbers since the Israel-Hamas war began in October. Usama Andrabi, Communications Director for Justice Democrats, one of the groups leading the coalition, said the strategy is to link up the grassroots organizations behind a seven-figure electoral defense campaign that aims not only to protect members of Congress being targeted by AIPAC, but also to bring light to what they see as the group's divergence from the longstanding values of the Democratic Party. And with that, we've come to the end of our reading of the Cape Cod Times for today, Tuesday, March 12th of 2024. This is your reader, Eric, saying be well, be safe, look after each other. Remember our veterans. Bye for now.